I want you to think about this picture for a minute. We're not going to talk about it immediately, but if you've ever done a puzzle, you take an individual puzzle piece and you go, well, this is not the whole picture. But if you get enough of them put together, you begin to accumulate something like the puzzle up here. We're missing a couple of pieces. Eventually, I guess it's going to be a castle of some kind, some pretty fancy place. But that's the point of a puzzle, isn't it? The individual pieces give you just a partial picture of what's going on, then you put them together and you get the whole picture. So we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes today. But what I wanted to do today was to give you, in a sense, a cumulative case for the reason that we can trust the Gospels. And one particular way we can trust the Gospels is that they're eyewitness reports. And of course, that's controversial these days. So I'm not going to land and stay on one thing very long. I want to go through these seven very quickly. I do talks on these. You can go out on the website and find out more information. But I want to talk about these as a cumulative case. And then I want to spend time on the new thing that's come along in the last, let's say, 10 years that talks about what are called interlocking Gospels. So I'm going to spend more time on that than these seven. So you may say, wow, he's really speeding through this. Yeah, because you can get more information on another time, or I'll come in sometime and do a talk on this. But we're going to talk about these seven things briefly, all adding up to the cumulative case that we can trust the Gospels because they're eyewitness reports. So that's the key thing there, eyewitness reports. So number one, what's the first reason we can trust them as eyewitness accounts? Because the people who wrote them said they were eyewitness reports. So Luke, now Luke was not the eyewitness, but notice what he says. I myself have investigated everything, and he says he's talked to the eyewitnesses. First chapter of Luke, second chapter of Luke, who do you suppose he talked to? We get more about one person in Luke than we do in the other Gospels. Mary. We get the song of Mary. We get the whole story from Mary's perspective. So wouldn't that have been something? You're sitting down there and you're talking to Mary, the mother of Jesus, and to hear those stories gives you goosebumps thinking about it. Second Peter, what does he say? He says, in a sense, he knows some people are going to say, oh, you guys are just fabricating this stuff. He says, no. He says, we told you about the coming Lord Jesus. We were eyewitnesses. And by the way, do you notice none of these people ever recanted this stuff? They never said, oh, come on, we're just making it up. Can't you guys take a joke? They went to their deaths, and none of them recounted this. They stuck to the idea, we were eyewitnesses. First John, he says, we heard it, we saw it, we looked at it, our hands have touched him. This is who we're talking about. That's close contact. Not at a distance, but somebody up close. We were there. We experienced Jesus Christ. And so just the story coming out of the mouths of the people, they said they were eyewitnesses. Number two, archaeology backs it up as an eyewitness account. And the reason I say that is I want you to think about this. Jerusalem gets knocked down in 70 AD. By whom, do you know? The Romans. If they want you down, they're going to take you down. You don't mess with the Romans. And the Jews thought they would win. What were they thinking? So the Romans come in and they put a stranglehold on the city, and finally they come through and they just knock down everything. Now think about this. If you don't have eyewitnesses that do the gospel stories and somebody makes them up hundreds of years later, are they going to get the archaeology right of Jerusalem? No. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. In John 5, they talk about these colonnades that were around the Pool of Bethesda. And John is specific. He said there are five of them. And so for hundreds of years, nobody knew. The city was just trashed. And then finally, archaeology got to work, and you've seen pieces of Jerusalem that are fixed up these days. And guess how many porticos they found? Five. So you've got accounts coming from these people who were there seem to be accurate to what really went on. For a long time, they poo-pooed the idea that there was a first century Nazareth. They said, oh, there's no such place as Nazareth. And then guess what they've done? Archaeology's gotten to work with the spades, and they've uncovered first century Nazareth. And Luke is a terrific eyewitness, by the way. People call him a terrific historian. He's an amazing historian. How about this? Here's another reason we can trust them as eyewitnesses. We've got manuscript evidence that goes way, way back. Now, a lot of people are maybe not aware of this, but we do not have the originals. There's no original Luke sitting in a Vatican museum. There's not an original Matthew sitting in another museum. So we don't have the originals. But we don't have the originals of any of these older historical works of Thucydides and Homer and Herodotus and Tacitus. We don't have them. So what you want, obviously, is the closer the copy to the original, the better. And thank goodness, the Gospels are way closer to the originals than any other type of ancient literature. It's an abundance of resources, and they're very, very close. A fragment of John has been dated to 125 AD. It's about the size of a credit card. Well, that's pretty close, isn't it? So you're getting back there far enough, it's possible they were eyewitnesses. And I put a little question mark because nobody's ever come out yet to announce it. They said they're on a vow of silence for a while. But there's evidence starting to trickle out that they have a first century piece of mark. So it's moving back, it's moving back, it's moving back closer and closer. No way could these things have been written 300 or 400 years later. They're finding pieces that take you back into the first century. Fourth, how about the church fathers? Now, that may you may think, oh, here we go, Eastern Orthodox or Catholic or something like that. But we're talking before the establishment of those kinds of churches. You had John, you had Peter, you had Paul, you had all these other people preaching, and then when they preached, they would get their own disciples, and they would work with those people, and those people would go on and become what they called church fathers in the second century. And guess what they said over and over again? They unanimously, there was never any disagreement, they unanimously said, we have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. They were either written by eyewitnesses or people who saw the eyewitnesses and dealt with the eyewitnesses. So there's not any other story coming out about, well, it was years later, or well, we don't really know. Every one of them said Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. How about number five? Oral tradition. Now, a lot of people get a little nervous when we talk oral tradition. They think of the telephone game. Remember that one? You started in a circle and you whispered something and they whispered it and it went around and it came back and it was all messed up. It was just totally different. Everybody has a good laugh. That's not what we're talking about. Oral tradition is very different when it comes to ancient cultures. So I'm just going to leave it for that right now. But we can trust these sources. The oral traditions are even earlier than the gospel accounts. How about this? Historians inside and outside the Bible have agreed with those original eyewitness accounts. So I'll just give you a couple examples. Tacitus is a Roman historian. He's not a Christian. And he tells the story that he's heard that sounds exactly like the gospel accounts. So he's taking it way back to the beginning of the story of Jesus. Josephus, a Jewish historian. Was he a Christian? No. Does he tell the same story? Yes. So we're not getting different stories accumulating over the years. They all come back to that eyewitness time period. Richard Bauckham, I'm going to introduce one more recent guy to you. He wrote a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It's a big old fat book, and he spends the whole book with the title saying, these are not later stories that people were just making up sitting around the campfire. These are stories written by eyewitnesses. And he gives just one example. I'll just share that with you today before we move on. He says, Jewish names, the popularity changed over the years. Just like after World War II, you didn't really name too many kids Adolf in this country. Kind of disappeared, right? Just, it's gone. Well, the same thing would apply to the Jewish names. There would be certain popular names that would come and they would go. And they know this because they've gone to 1st century and 2nd century and 3rd century sources outside the Bible to look at the names that were the most popular. And when you match up what were the most popular 1st century names outside the New Testament with what the New Testament has as the most popular names, it's a good match. And so it's a good reason to believe that, again, this is 1st century early eyewitness reporting that's going on in the Gospels. And then the last one before I focus on what I wanted to do today. I hope you realize inside the New Testament, like little nuggets, are buried things called creeds. And creeds are just short ways to memorize key things about whatever it is you want to memorize. Maybe you worked at a business and they had like a motto, or they had some kind of business mission statement. You know what I'm talking about? They're always little short things that you can memorize and it helps you understand the company. Well, early Christians had these creeds too. And we've got one in 1 Corinthians. If you look in the first few verses of 1 Corinthians, Paul says, I'm passing this along to you. He said, I'm not making it up. I got it from other people. And that creed, people are dating it because they can read the language, the way it's put together. They think that creed is at the worst about 2 years, within 2 years of the time of Jesus. And it tells the same story as what we've got in the Gospels. So it's amazing. You've got these seven pieces of evidence that the Christian story that we get is accurate to what Jesus said, to what he did, and certainly to the resurrection. Thank goodness, yes? Well, here's the thing I wanted to focus on today, though. It's called interlocking gospels. Some people call it undesigned coincidences. I always thought that was a weird term. I like interlocking gospels. So I wanted to start, and remember that puzzle picture I had for you at the beginning here? I want you to think about somebody named J. Warner Wallace. He's a cold case detective. He's come to Emmanuel Faith in the past. I hope you had a chance to hear him. He was in the main sanctuary on a Friday. And so he's a hard-nosed detective. He wasn't a Christian. as he grew up and as he got his job. And he started finally going to church because he thought it'd be good for his kids. And he started looking through the Gospels for the first time. And here's what he said. If you have multiple eyewitnesses that see the same event, they never tell you the same story. Remember, he's a cold case detective, so he talked to hundreds of eyewitnesses. They never tell you the same story, but they do tell you a story that can be put together like a puzzle. I was seeing these characteristics in the Gospels, and I thought, wow, the stuff feels and looks a lot like, what? Eyewitness testimony. So he says, when you go to an accident scene, let's say, maybe it's a murder scene, and he said the first rule for a detective is never let the witnesses get together. Because they start comparing, oh, well, maybe it wasn't that. Oh, maybe, okay, maybe you're right. So he says you keep them separate. And then you sit them down and you say, what did you see? Describe the person. What actions did you see? Did you hear anything? That person leaves. You talk to person number two, eyewitness three, eyewitness four. And then what do? You put it all together and you get the truth. But each person is going to have a slightly different perspective. And you have to interlock them like a puzzle before you see the whole picture, in this case, a murder scene or something. So we're going to apply the same thing to the Gospels. About 150 years ago, somebody wrote a book on this idea of interlocking Gospels, and then it kind of died off. Nobody had heard about it for a long, long time until within about the last 20 years, there's a Christian, I'll mention him later on, who was looking through some old manuscript evidence and came across some old Christian documents. He got really excited about this, and he started to do a lot of writing, a lot of speaking on it. His wife has written a book that's dynamite, and I'll mention that in just a couple minutes. So here's what we're talking about. You look at the four Gospels. This is just our practice run before we look at some specific cases. What did the sign say that was posted over the cross that Jesus was on? Matthew says, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Mark says, the King of the Jews. Luke says, this is the King of the Jews. John says, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Now, notice each one is slightly different. But do you think you could put them together? What do you suppose? Probably a lot of John, maybe. Rick?
Apostles written in three different languages.
Yeah, yeah. You could maybe start with John. He's got maybe most of the details. Jesus of Nazareth. Maybe we're done. Maybe it's John. I mean, you look at the others, and they've all got those things about this is Jesus. This is the claim. That's a claim in Mark. There's the claim in Luke. So, I mean, you could get enough of an idea from looking at these four. You lock them together, and you got a better picture. So let me show you some examples here from the Bible. From the New Testament. Matthew 26. This is when Jesus is on trial and they're going to really have fun with him because they don't believe him. It says they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you? Now, if somebody walks up to you and slaps you and says, can you guess who hit you? You know who hit you because you saw that person walk up. So you look at this and you go, well, what kind of test is this? So if you just read Matthew, you would say, I'm a little confused. I mean, the wording is there, but it seems odd. And then you read the other part, and that's Luke 22. It's the same episode. And what do you hear this time? The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded and demanded, prophesy, who hit you? So what's the new piece of evidence that we had here that we didn't have in Matthew? The blindfold. So do you see what's happened? You took two pieces of the Gospels, one by itself, maybe you have a question, you put the two together, you go, okay, makes sense. So that's interlocking. You needed both of them to get the picture of what we're talking about. Here's another example, Matthew 8:16. Jesus has just healed, early in the day, Peter's mother-in-law, and it says, when evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. Now my question to you, and I think you'd have the same question, they waited until evening. The word's out. Jesus has healed. Jesus does these miraculous things. You got the sick person, you say, hang around for a while. We'll go in the evening. Why wouldn't you go over there immediately and say, well, we don't want to lose him. Let's make sure he's still here. Quick, you know, let's wrap this person up and get him or her over there. Well, if you read Mark, same episode, earlier in the day, they went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went in the synagogue, began to teach, and then they go over to the home of Simon and Andrew. Now, what do you learn here that you didn't get from the other one? The what?
Sundown.
Yeah, it's Sabbath. You don't go traveling. You don't do things until sundown comes. So they've got to sit there with a sick person looking out every once in a while. Come on, son. And when it goes down, then they come out and they're all going over to see Jesus. But you didn't get that from the first one, did you? You got it because of that second example. This one's probably my favorite. Instead of taking two pieces of the gospel to interlock, we're going to get three in this one. So here's the first of three. This is the famous feeding of the 5,000, John 6:5. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where should we buy bread for these people to eat?" Now, of all the disciples, if you're making this up 200 years, 300 years later, and it's not eyewitness, would you pick Philip to be the guy Jesus would deal with? Was he one of the best known? Yeah, you might even leave him off the list if you're trying to write down the 12 disciples. You might say, so he said to Peter, or he said to John. You'd pick the big heavy hitters, wouldn't you? But he turns to Philip. Philip doesn't get much press in the rest of the New Testament, does he? Not much. So you go, why in the world would he turn to Philip? We don't know just from reading this. So let's go one other place. Let's go to earlier in John. We find out that Philip, like these other two, are from the town of Bethsaida. Well, so far that's nice to know, but it doesn't really help us with the other part, why Jesus turned to Philip. Well, we find out a little bit about his background. But here's the last piece. We got to go to Luke. When the apostles returned, they reported to Jesus what they'd done. He took them with him, and they withdrew where? To Bethsaida. So why does Jesus turn to
He knows the area. He knows where.
I lost it again here. Philip, there we go. Why did he turn to Philip? He knows the area. He says, "Hey, you're from here. Where can we get some grub? We've got to get some food for these people. Here they come." So you say, "Ah, okay, made sense." But it made sense after you put three of them together. Here's example number four from Matthew. As Jesus is walking beside the Sea of Galilee. This is the first encounter, by the way, apparently, at least from Matthew. He's walking along. He sees these two brothers, Simon and Andrew. They're casting a net. They're fishermen. "Come follow me," Jesus said, "and I'll make you fishers of men." At once they left their nets and followed him. There's no previous information as to why these guys, these are hardened men. They're down-to-earth guys, aren't they? They're fishermen. They're doing some tough work. And some guy drifts by. And he says, "Hey, come follow me, give up what you're doing." And they just toss their nets and they go follow him. You think, well, did he have a halo around his head? I mean, what's the deal with that? Why would you leave everything and follow a guy if this is the first time you encountered him? Well, apparently it wasn't. Let's get the rest of the story. Here's Luke 8. I'm sorry it's a little bit longer here. We first meet Peter in chapter 4 of Luke. It says he heals the mother-in-law. So that's the first time we meet Simon Peter. So he goes into the mother-in-law and heals her up from a high fever. And then we pick up in Luke 5. One day Jesus was standing by the lake. All these people are crowding around him. They're listening. And there's too many people. So he gets in one of the boats, and it's Simon's boat. He says, "Could you put out a little bit from shore?" And he starts teaching. And then you know the rest of the story? He says, "Let's go out a little deeper, guys." And Peter says, with great faith, "Nah. We're not going to catch anything. We've had a bad day. You can go on out." So all of a sudden, they're just dragging up. They got to get help. They got so many fish coming up out of this net. Now, does that make sense at that point? They left everything and followed him. Do they have reason? So were they just sitting on the shore, just a guy drifts by, and they say, "Yeah, I guess we'll follow him." I mean, they saw the healing, and then they dealt with him as he was working with the crowd, and then he takes him out in the boat further and pulls up this enormous catch. No wonder they're willing to say, "This is somebody I want to follow. I like his message. I like what he's doing. He's got all the hallmarks of the Messiah. He's healing." We've heard that over and over again. When Messiah comes, he's going to have healing in his wings. So they said, "Drop the nets. We've got something way more important to do." How about another one here? Luke 9:36. Jesus has just, in a sense, stripped off the outer garments and revealed himself on the Mount of Transfiguration. And the disciples see that. And there's Moses and there's Elijah. Did they have name tags? I don't know how you... Anyway, so there they are. They're with Jesus. And what an amazing moment. And they come down the hill, and it says they told no one at that time what they'd seen. So, I mean, can you imagine you're Peter and you come back home, and his wife's there, says, "Did you see Jesus today?" "Yeah." "Did you guys have a good time?" "Yeah." "Anything special happen?" "No, not really." I mean, wouldn't you say, "We saw Moses, we saw Elijah, Jesus was blinding." They don't say anything. And that's the only thing we get from the story in Luke. But if you look in Mark, Jesus said, don't tell anybody. Keep quiet. So don't do it until after the Son of Man has risen from the dead. So Jesus is on a time schedule there. He doesn't want to be the Messiah too early. I think there's a reason for that. If you go to the book of Daniel, that's a different talk. So anyway, Jesus, this is not his time. You remember how many occasions he says, my time has not yet come. So his time had not yet come. So he says, this is for you guys. It's private. So they honor that. I mean, wouldn't you honor that after you saw the blinding glare of Jesus' divinity? Yeah, you wouldn't want to spoil that. We'll do one last example here. Pilate has the life or death for Jesus. He can decide to let him go or he can put him to death. And they want Jesus, the leaders, of course, want to get rid of Jesus. So they lead him off to Pilate. And Pilate asks him, hey, you're here on a charge of insurrection. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus says, yes. Pilate looks at him and says, okay, no problem, no charge. Now, wait a minute. If you're Pilate, what's your job?
Keep order.
Keep order. The worst thing that can happen, especially these obnoxious Jews, I mean, they're always ready to revolt. They don't honor Caesar. They don't want to honor Caesar. They want God in the place of Caesar. So it's always like whack-a-mole with the Jews, trying to keep them under some kind of control. And so here comes this guy who's obviously got a heck of a following, and he says to you, I'm the king of the Jews. And Pilate says, no problem, go on and be free. Well, it doesn't make sense until you pick up in John, same episode, Pilate asks him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. Now, why is that an okay thing for Pilate? It's not a threat. This guy is not a political threat. It's maybe some kind of a spiritual deal, but what does Pilate care about a spiritual king? You can have all the spiritual kings you want. We got one king, Caesar, and he's the guy that's keeping me here. And if I don't keep a lid on that, the political part of this, I'm in major trouble. So he's okay with that. He'll let Jesus go. Are there more verses like this? Are these the only ones? No, there are dozens and dozens. I just hit a few of them that I found interesting. So you can have a field day. Frankly, what I think is interesting is sometimes you can go with a gospel account to an outside source, not just gospel account to another gospel account. So I'll give you two examples of those, but there are even more of these. So for example, you know the story in Matthew? They've left with the child and they've gone to Egypt to hide out for a while. And then they find out Herod's dead and they're told you can go back to Galilee now. But look what it says. Matthew says when Joseph heard about it, that Archelaus, who's the son, he's in charge, he was afraid to go up to Galilee. He was afraid. So you go, well, Herod was a pretty terrible person. What's the problem here? Well, Archelaus, if you read Josephus, the Jewish historian, he tells you how Archelaus slaughtered the Jews. He hated the Jews, and he was ready at any moment to send his legions out and to stomp on Jews. On one occasion, he killed something like 2,000 or 3,000 of them. He got them in one area, and had the legions surround them and just cut them down. So that's why we don't get the story in Matthew, but we get the story if you go to another historian. How about Acts 19? There's a reference there that some historians scratched their heads about, and they said, well, wait a minute, they're talking about this riot in Ephesus, and they're mentioning there are proconsuls, plural. And people that knew history said, wait a minute, the Romans didn't have more than one proconsul. Somebody's wrong here, and I bet it's the New Testament. No. If you read Tacitus, a Roman historian, he says, normally they had one, but two of them were ruling in 54 AD. And that's the time period of Acts. So there you go. You got verification from Acts through a secular historian. So there are all of these things that are all over the place. I hope you find them interesting. I did. Here's the conclusion. The Gospels are eyewitness events. That's the thing I hope is the takeaway for you here today. And the other thing is that those seven items I mentioned at first, plus this, to me that's like accumulating a case. I wouldn't depend on one that's going to convince somebody, oh, I'm not sure it's eyewitness, but you keep throwing out all these pieces that I gave you, and pretty soon it's overwhelming. It's like, yeah, it sounds like they probably are eyewitnesses. The Gospels are trustworthy. And then it's really unlikely that you would have this odd interlocking situation if they were borrowing from each other. It would be the same, wouldn't it? If Luke is borrowing from Matthew or Matthew's borrowing from Mark, they're not going to have these discrepancies. It's the eyewitness approach that gives you these discrepancies. And fictions and forgeries don't do this. Can you imagine if you're going to make up something? You don't want to make up something that leaves people kind of in the dark. You want it as clear as possible. You don't want to leave any loose ends. You don't want to have people scratching their heads going, I don't get this. This doesn't seem complete. You don't want people questioning anything. You want it complete and total. So forgeries don't work as well this way. Here's that book I mentioned before by Lydia McGrew. It's called, it's kind of a dim picture, but it's called Hidden in Plain View. And can you see the little puzzle pieces at the top there? She spent a whole book on this, if you think this is fascinating stuff, an entire book that looks at a lot of verses, and they spend way more time than I have a chance today. If you want some more information, Tim McGrew, who's the husband, he's the one that came up with this and started kind of coming up with these things from the old writings of the 1800s. He's got a talk. You can access it on the internet. And he's got a different title for it. He calls it Undesigned Coincidences. But if you just want to hear him talk about it, he spends more time than I'm able to today. J. Warner Wallace has a terrific book that looks at the New Testament, the gospel stories, and why we can trust them. Again, more than I've been able to give you here today. But he's got a book, Cold Case Christianity, and he's got his own website, coldcasechristianity.com. And, of course, you can email me, and I'd be glad to send you out any information that you want.